Those individuals who achieve a certain amount of success or fame begin to get asked how they achieved it, and if possible, to enumerate some rules for living so that people might emulate them. This has proved to be difficult for even the best of authors. For some reason, a lot of the answers seem to come down to maintaining your ability to curse. Samuel Butler, the author of the very successful utopian satire Erewhon, was asked to create some rules for living. One of his answers was that you might as well obey the Ten Commandments because they don't forbid swearing. Similarly, when Thomas Jefferson's 10 rules for living included, when angry, count to 10 before you speak. If very angry, count to 100. Mark Twain offered his own variant, if angry, count to 4. If very angry, swear. So you'd think that from certain points of view, being successful in life means maintaining an appropriate outlet for your rage. There are, of course, some of these for baseball, but most of them aren't of much use. They generally come down to stay in shape, work hard, that kind of generic thing. Some of them might even be disadvantageous or downright dangerous. The Hall of Fame pitcher Herb Pennock had 10 commandments for pitching, and the 10th of them was, work for what is called a rag arm. A loose arm can pitch overhanded, sidearm, three-quarter, underhanded, any old way, to suit the situation at hand. I'm not advising Clayton Kershaw to do that. Are you advising Clayton Kershaw to do that? Are you going to pay for his surgery? Are you going to fend off the hitmen that the Dodgers hire to kill you? No, I didn't think so. And Herb Pennock, that racist old bastard, he's beyond vengeance. So it's probably better to let that particular piece of advice go to dust in the foggy tombs of time, along with other defunct ideas like vital humors or bipartisanship. Those that aren't strictly focused on the game, though, remain valuable. And by this, of course, I'm referring to Satchel Paige's rules for staying young, which are worth hearing again, even though you've heard them a million times. Number 1, avoid fried meats, which angry up the blood. Number 2, if your stomach disputes you, lie down and pacify it with cool thoughts. Number 3, keep the juices flowing by jangling around gently as you move. 4, go very light on the vices, such as carrying on in society. The social ramble ain't restful. Number 5, avoid running at all times. And 6, most famously, don't look back. Something might be gaining on you. Then again, some of them that are directly focused on baseball are pretty useful if you just interpret them correctly. Joe McCarthy, who managed his way to 9 pennants and 7 World Series titles in the 1930s and 40s with the Cubs and Yankees, had a list that seems to go beyond baseball, even if it never mentions anything but baseball. He had rules like, nobody can become a ball player by walking after a ball. Keep your head up, and you may not have to keep it down. When you start to slide, slide. He who changes his mind may have to change a good leg for a bad one. I've actually seen that lead to injury in ball games. Best of all, though, are rules 6 through 8, which can be combined into one very basic, resilient philosophy. I'm just going to read them as one paragraph. Do not alibi on bad hops. Anybody can field the good ones. Always run them out. You never can tell. Do not quit. I once said that to my grandfather when he was very ill. I said, do not quit. He promised me he wouldn't, but time has a way of making lies of even our most solemn promises. He would have kept it if he could. Well, I'll make you a promise. We're here together, and I won't quit if you don't. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Has gone up and you've found yourself in episode 3. In a moment, I'll be joined by the wise, warm, and witty David Roth of Vice Sports, and he and I will talk about the occasionally slight rewards of being a Mets fan, how to talk to fantasy players at parties and to your therapist about foreign policy, and what it is that wayward team owners owe to their fans. I will warn you that despite my own propensity for swearing when I'm not in front of this microphone, we've been totally clean to this point. However, we do have some mild cussing in this episode. If that offends you, I apologize. Second, we discussed the Matt Harvey situation extensively. Whereas I think that most or all of what we said is still accurate, this was recorded on Monday, and some further details about the Harvey situation had not yet emerged at that time. All of that is coming up directly. Before then, though, I want to talk about a problem which afflicts many of us here in the Infinite Inning. Friends, do you suffer from Shoeless Joe Jackson syndrome? No, I don't mean that you would hijack a World Series for your own personal benefit or lose a batting title race to Ty Cobb because he gaslighted you, but rather those feelings of shame and embarrassment that haunt you after you've thrown a World Series for your own personal benefit or even made a mistake that is far more trivial than that. There are those who can't escape the infinite inning because they've been here so long they can't imagine there's another way to live. If you've drunk deeply of shame and have the deep certainty that you've made mistakes that mark you as a failure, as a flawed or bad person, then you've foreclosed your escape. Shame, which is the only emotion that comes to you via other people, or at least primarily via other people, and their reactions to the things that you've done, is a jail sentence without a parole. Everyone deserves a life of infinite possibility, but those that are locked in by shame don't allow themselves to have it. There are degrees of mistakes, of course, degrees to which we all fail to live up to our best selves. I think it's important to note that not all of these disappointments, whether we've disappointed ourselves or others, and there's a question as to whether that latter point is even important, those mistakes are not reducible to evil impulses. None of us has the right to be evil or to have bad intentions or to treat other people badly on purpose. But we do have the right to err, to make mistakes, to misunderstand. In short, to be human without earning the condemnation of our fellow men and women. You say, but Steve, old man, and by old man I am not addressing you as if I was in an old P.G. Woodhouse Jeeves and Wooster story, but literally as an old man. This is the age of the internet. We go on there purely to get the baseball scores and point out where other people have screwed up repeatedly and at great length. And I say, sure. Okay, that's a very human impulse. You're talking to a guy who, as a kid, was playing kickball and wearing a pair of shorts that was just a little too loose, and as he rounded first after scoring a hit, had those pants drop right to the ground. And I think even I would have made fun of me at that moment. So I get it. I get the impulse. When somebody looks dumb, it's hilarious to point it out. That's fine. The problem is that life is not like a play or a movie. You have been shamed, and there's no curtain falling, there's no freeze frame, there's no fade to black. Life goes on. Even the worst of pariahs, the biblical Cain, right? He doesn't end in that story. He wanders off and goes to dwell in the land of east, north, south, west of not, I forget which, east of Eden, whatever, east of Hoboken. That's the inhumanity of it. In fact, the inhumanity of it may even conceal a worse impulse. In the book So You've Been Publicly Shamed, Mike Daisy, who wrote and performed monologues on This American Life and was caught to have, shall we say, inflated or exaggerated certain aspects of the stories that he was telling and caught out, said, it feels like they want an apology, but it's a lie. It's a lie because they don't want an apology. An apology is supposed to be a communion, a coming together. For someone to make an apology, someone has to be listening. They listen and you speak and there's an exchange. What they want is my destruction. What they want is for me to die. Reading that to you and thinking of some of the experiences I've had in social media, such as on Twitter, I'm reminded of the story, and I don't know if it's true, that the rook, which is a very social bird, kind of like a crow, will form a group called a parliament, will surround one member of the community, and then peck it to death for some trespass that we can only imagine. Being shamed is like that. To continue with the ornithological analogy for a minute, and by the way, I prefer the ornithologically correct Orioles cap. I know that's not a popular thing to say, but I just want to get that out there and be proud of it. I like an accurate bird, not a cartoon bird. Anyway, speaking of cartoon birds, or a bird that's often a cartoon, shame is the cuckoo of human emotions. The cuckoo is not just a bird that lives in mechanical clocks. It lays its eggs in the nests of other birds. And then when they hatch, the baby cuckoo pushes the mother's true chicks out of the nest so that it alone will thrive. Similarly, when your mind is invested by shame, your own good feelings about yourself, your healthy ego, I'm not talking about conceit, I'm talking about the part of you that makes you feel good about you so that you can operate every day, your self-esteem, those are replaced by another person's judgment, disdain, and hate, which you then nurture as your own. And that brings us to Shoeless Joe Jackson. There's a coda to his story that I think illustrates the perniciousness of shame. I don't want to assume that everyone listening to a baseball podcast knows who or what Joe Jackson was, so just a few quick points. He was from South Carolina, born there in 1887. He was an outfielder and a tremendous hitter. A young Babe Ruth copied his swing, that's how good he was. And although he was illiterate, he wasn't a total bumpkin. He did, for one thing, own shoes. There was just one day that his shoes were missing, or they hadn't arrived, or they hadn't been broken in, and he played the outfield in socks, and from then on, he was Shoeless Joe. He made it to the majors in 1908 with Connie Mack's A's, but things didn't really work out. Jackson was unhappy, missed his young wife, and whenever Mack would have his back turned, Jackson would hop a train and head back to South Carolina. There was nothing that Mack could do to stop this, and whatever overtures he made, including offering to teach Jackson to read, were rejected. The other A's didn't much like Jackson either, so Mack gave up. In 1910, he traded him to Cleveland. That's where he started to hit. He was more comfortable there for some reason. Maybe there were more Southern players on the team. In 1911, he hit .408 and everybody knew that a star had arrived. By the time he was traded to the White Sox in 1915, he was a very successful ball player, but that doesn't mean he was any more sophisticated than he had been back with Connie Mack. This was still a grown man who couldn't order for himself in a restaurant, but had to listen to what his teammates asked for and then select something that they had said because he was incapable of choosing off of the menu. When seven of his teammates conspired to fix the 1919 World Series for gamblers, he went along with it, and he got paid, at least to some extent, not because he wanted to fix the World Series, but because everyone else is doing it and you might as well get something. He may even have played all out. Certainly his record in the series is very good. Nonetheless, conspiracy is a crime, and he was banned for life from baseball. Jackson was the first of the Black Sox players to die, but he still lived for 31 years after that, sometimes remorseful, sometimes defiant, all the while feeling like he was unwelcome in the place that he most wanted to be, and not only unwelcome by Judge Landis and the other powers of baseball, but by his peers. In 1947, he owned a liquor store in Greenville, South Carolina. The sports writer Grantland Rice and Ty Cobb had gone together to view the Masters in Augusta, Georgia. As they drove north, they decided to stop off and see how Jackson was doing. They went into the liquor store. Jackson was behind the counter. He and Cobb made eye contact, but no words were said. Cobb busied himself, wandering about the aisles, not really sure what to do. Jackson didn't say anything at all. Finally, to end the awkwardness, Cobb selected a bottle and brought it to the counter. When Jackson still didn't say anything, Cobb said, "Joe, don't you know me?" "Of course I know you, Ty, but I didn't know if you wanted to know me. A lot of them don't." Rice wrote in his autobiography, The Tumult and the Shouting, "The three of them then fell into easy talking, reminiscing about old times, Cobb probably bragging about how he psyched Jackson out of the batting title one year." Rice wrote, "Jackson died 4 years later. Cobb's paying Jackson a visit must have been the high point in the waning limbo years of one of baseball's natural greats, a fall guy in that 1919 Black Sox scandal." Listen to that. It's framed as charity. Cobb was doing him a favor. Cobb was deigning, descending into the Stygian depths of that South Carolina liquor store to visit this fallen man, whether you thought he was a fall guy or not. But no. Jackson had just been a guy in his early 30s who had listened to his teammates, who had given in to peer pressure, who had been relentlessly, incredibly stupid, especially given that in the end, he did play to win. But you see, Rice could write what he wrote because Jackson didn't stand up for himself. Jackson didn't introduce himself. He shrunk behind the counter, didn't speak until spoken to, didn't acknowledge Cobb until Cobb acknowledged him. And I'll tell you something, forfeiting a World Series is a terrible, terrible thing. But even murderers sometimes get paroled. And a man who had hit .356 in the major leagues deserved to hold his head up high no matter what happened in the 1919 World Series. That was a serious crime, a terrible betrayal of the trust of the American people. But even if the public hadn't forgiven Jackson, and had a right not to forgive Jackson, Jackson had a right to forgive himself. Jackson was about to go on television and talk about the 1919 World Series fix when a heart attack suddenly killed him in 1951. Would that appearance have provided a catharsis? Would he have felt forgiven, or forgiven himself? We'll never know. More importantly, he never knew. So this is my message for you today. Don't be Shoeless Joe Jackson. I'm not talking about the World Series. I'm not talking about gamblers. I mean, don't screw up and participate in a World Series fix. That seems kind of obvious. Be honest and comport yourself so that everything you do is worthy of your name. But what I really mean is let it go. If they say that you're bad, if they say you've done wrong, if they no longer speak to you, that's their problem. There are plenty of people who will. There's not a cloud over your head. There's not a shroud covering your face. You're just you, and all your sins are invisible. Forgive yourself, even if they won't. It's too much fun for them not to. And here's the best part of that. They've all, in their own ways, fixed their own World Series. You know the saying, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. No, that's not right. Let he who is without sin cast the last stone. And then, once and for all, let it be over. The sum of you is worth more than your lowest moment. A line from a Robin Hitchcock song seems appropriate here. He wrote, I've never seen a man so abuse his reflection. I'll be back with David Roth in just a moment. David, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. You had warned me ahead of time that you were vocally compromised due to a rough weekend, and I immediately had auditory visions. Is that a thing?
Of really depends what you've taken. Yeah.
True. Very true. I think we've both been there. But I was thinking of Wendell Willkie in the 1940 campaign against Franklin Roosevelt. I have a clip somewhere of him campaigning against Roosevelt and saying, join me in our crusade to save democracy, which is not how he sounded normally. And people actually thought he was a great guy. And in fact, for a Republican, they thought he was a Democrat. But I thought you were going to be like that. And no, not at all. You sound like you're ready to belt out some show tunes.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm a little bit more gravelly, and I think I have a little bit more presence. And I would even go so far as to say a little bit more sex appeal this way. But it's only because of how shitty I sounded yesterday, which I was sick. I mean, I am still kind of sick. I know this is the stuff listeners crave. I'll go into the allergy stuff more later, I promise. Just make sure I circle back to it.
Yeah, it's a special segment. We'll have a theme song, a particular theme for that, the allergy theme.
Yeah, like a Pollen Count song by the Fountains of Wayne or something. You got to commission some good stuff. But I blew my voice out at my wife's reunion weekend because I was in at this like after party. It was very loud. And I was explaining to people who actually wanted to hear it the story of the Bill Ripken Fleer card. And I'd enjoyed telling this story. I would tell it to strangers if it wasn't the sort of thing that could get you in trouble. I really had to lean into it. But when I got back to the hotel and realized that my voice was pretty shot, I would also realize that the reason for that was that I needed to let people know about that baseball card.
I don't know if it was this kind of experience that you were having, but what I always dread is going to somebody's social event and the host is trying to play matchmaker sort of, or conversational matchmaker. What typically happens is I get stood next to some guy named Fred, and the host will say, Fred, Steve writes professionally about baseball. Steve, Fred has a fantasy team. Well, I'll leave you two to get to know each other. And then that's when you have to fall back on some story that you can tell quickly and entertainingly and then say, oh, I think one of my children is on fire. Excuse me.
Yeah. I mean, that is an experience I've had as well. I also feel like I've developed, I think probably mostly as a coping mechanism, a real tolerance for like helping random guys troll the waiver wire of their fantasy leagues. Like, if it comes to that, like, I have thoughts about Nomar Mazara. Like, I'll share them if you want. Like, I seldom am asked, you know, but if it comes to that, it's a party, you know, there's no rules.
They never express themselves that way to me, though. If it was like that, if it was like, Steve, as long as I have a man of your expertise here, which is a debatable or dubious proposition in the first place, but if they had just said, you know, Steve, as long as I have a man of your experience here, can you tell me I'm in need of a shortstop? Can you recommend somebody? But it's never like that. It's always, I always say that telling somebody about your fantasy team is like telling somebody about your dreams. Like, it has to be somebody who's very involved with your life and your well-being to begin with. Otherwise, it's just, you know, and again, I respect it if you like that, if you play that. For me, I gave it up a long time ago because it's too much of a good thing. But usually what Fred says is like, okay, well, at catcher, I have Travis d'Arnaud and I have that guy with the A's backing him up. I can't remember his name. Then at first base, I have Lyle Overbay. I'm like, didn't Lyle Overbay retire like 10 years ago? What, you know, and then that asking that question then encourages them to keep going.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, this is the thing that's kind of the, I guess it's not really that darkly comic, but the funny part of having this as a job is that, like, you know, at some point, I think once I realized that I was not going to make a living playing baseball, so I was early 20s probably, this seemed like a decent enough fallback, you know, the idea of just thinking about it and writing about it. And so, like, I have a comparatively high tolerance for it without, you know, having to complain. But there are points where I get to, like, you know, talking about who's really lazy or anything like that. Like, I will absolutely pull the ripcord on that. I don't have children to claim that are on fire either, so I basically have nothing.
I think that's all the more reason to claim it.
Yeah, I was going to say it's actually more ethical if I do it.
Exactly. Because they could say, wait, I didn't think you have kids. And you would say, well, if I did, they would be on fire. And
yeah, or like, oh, my God, I need to go check. Maybe I do.
I need to get right on making some right now.
Yeah.
Where is the coat closet?
Well, I wish it was that kind of weekend, and it was just a pretty staid reunion, honestly.
Oh, okay. Well, before we get more onto the sportsness of everything and the baseballness of everything, I just want to say, if I can flatter you for a second,
I bet you could.
I'm going to try, but you know, there are always, and I'm sure you've had this experience too. I'm not fishing, so don't go for the obvious rejoinder to that. But there are always people, I have lists of people that I wish I wrote as well as, that when I read them, I feel like, why did I ever think that I could do this at all? Some of them are role models for me as writers, though it probably doesn't emerge in my writing at all. Guys like Robert Benchley and James Thurber and Harlan Ellison. And it's a long, long list. You're certainly one of those that I wish I could write as well as, not just for the turn of phrases or turn of phrase that you have in any column, these wonderful descriptions of things, but also, I know this is going to sound like a small thing, but it's such a mystery to me, your ability on Twitter to say these incredibly pithy, maxim-like, epigrammatic things. Yeah. That when a political site does a tweet roundup of sports, you're in there. And when a sports site does a political roundup of tweets, you're in there, or vice versa. And I find you in the most unexpected of places. I think I saw you on the New York Magazine website the other day with a basketball tweet. My experience is the more I tweet, the less followers I have. And, you know, I once asked you about this privately, and you said, well, you don't do enough on Twitter, which is true. But I do find that the more I do on Twitter, the harder backwards I row. I'm not asking what I'm doing wrong so much as where do you get that ability to encapsulate things so quotably?
Well, let me first of all just say thank you, and I agree with you. I'm good as hell. Good. Twitter's just a part of that. I'm great at a lot of things. Twitter, that's all reps. I mean, that's just practice. I think, like, it's not a skill that has any value except for that it amuses me and some other people, but it is definitely just a function of doing it a lot. I mean, I kind of wish in some ways that I don't know. I don't wish I tweeted less. I wish I read Twitter less. But it's like a fun little way to write, but it is definitely the sort of thing where it's not exactly the way that I usually write the things that I, you know, technically am writing for money and or for fun. And it's a little bit of a challenge in that regard, but it is like just sort of toggling between the two. But I like it. I like to think of it as an exercise, but mostly it's just a place to put jokes that I can't say because I'm either working from home and it'd be weird to say them out loud or because I'm in the office and nobody talks.
I don't think many people you would want to read the collected tweets of so-and-so, although now that Donald Trump is president, we will someday have the collected tweets of Donald Trump, just as the fact that...
Oh, God. Be like a whole wing of his presidential library is going
to
be that.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be. That happens. Every president gets a collection of public and private papers in between covers. So that's actually going to be a thing that happens. But I think yours would almost be, I don't mean almost, because his aren't readable, but yours actually would be readable, provided that some editor, I assume you wouldn't want that to be yourself, went through and grounded each one in context.
I wouldn't ask anybody to read 70,000 tweets or however many it is I have. I mean, that's like not my worst enemy, not the worst editor I ever had. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's weird. I wonder about it. I haven't really gone back and looked at the archive or anything like that, just because how much time would I have to have on my hands to want to do that? There's something about the way that Twitter has its own sort of like closed discourse in it, where I wonder if in 2 years, all of these are going to be completely unintelligible because the jokes are not just like fitting within the Twitter context, but fitting within the context of what everybody is clowning around about for that particular 10-day period. I know for sure that a lot of that stuff doesn't sort of stick. I mean, like beyond the like memes, which are like, you know, a picture of a condescending looking Gene Wilder with like 45 words of text about Sharia law around it or whatever, like not like those memes, but like memes of conversation or of humor, like those cycle in and out of existence so fast that I think if you go away for 3 days, you miss two of them.
For me, sometimes I have to piece it together, like your one about the basketball commentator and Crab Rangoon. I learned right then, and I think I knew this, that probably Crab Rangoon in any context would probably just be a hilarious clincher for almost any tweet story. I'm going to just try to drop that into conversation randomly from now on.
It sounds amazing. I mean, it's like the cellar door of cheesy, fake Asian American invented appetizers. It is, but yeah, I mean, Crab Rangoon works. I mean, the whole, it's funny. There's two Stephen A. Smith tweets. It's that one, and then there's one that Trevor Strunk did, Hegelbon at Hegelbon, which I prefer, of course, because I'm a gentleman, and also because I think mine is mostly about like silly sounds and imagining them in Stephen A. Smith's like sort of overdetermined cadence and shouting voice, whereas his actually gets at what is stupid about the way that those debate shows work, which is like somebody staking out a completely ideologically, morally, intellectually untenable position and then defending it like just to their last breath, and then like coming back from commercial break and doing the same shit all over again. So I think his is a little bit more substance to it. But yeah, I picked the one with the stupid appetizer. So I think we got some things right.
Related to that, related to the tweeting, because you are a Swiss Army knife tweeter, by which I mean you don't strictly stick to sports, as people like us are often advised. Are you advised to stick to sports? Because you've been jumping around for so long that I would think no.
Yeah, I think people have given up on it. Like, I mean, also because I never actually have had any expertise in sports, which helps. I mean, like, if you were to tweet about politics and then I were to tweet at you like a jerk, stick to baseball, it would be because you were just saying something about baseball that I didn't know. Whereas, like, I don't say things about sports that people don't know. I mean, I can, like, if I like look something up on Baseball Reference before everybody else does, then I can like tell you that Wade Boggs faced Bartolo Colon 9 times and never got on base or whatever. But that's not knowledge. I mean, it's a facility with search engines and my fairly fast typing. So yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody, if I had anything to say about sports, I think people would tell me to stick to it, but it's, as it is, it's the same garbage level of commentary, but on a fairly wide range of subjects. That's what I provide.
What I always find interesting about that is I respect smart people I'm not necessarily including either of us in that group, but I mean, the market will decide, or the audience will decide.
I'd sure put you in there, but yeah, moment by moment, I'm okay. But I think for that.
Yeah, exactly. It's moment to moment. You know, it's like that montage in the Albert Brooks film, Defending Your Life, where they reel off the 10 stupidest moments of his life.
Yeah.
If you catch anybody, if you catch Albert Einstein at the wrong moment, it's going to look pretty bad. But you hope, as you said, hour to hour, minute to minute, you hope that you don't set any, this is apparently a motif, set anything on fire.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say is that I respect people who are intelligent in general, and I get curious what other areas their knowledge can be applied to. So the fact that you can use your great brain to break down or say something clever, interesting about basketball or baseball or any sport, and then can deconstruct politics the same way. I don't see that as any different from what Nate Silver does in his own way, or what anybody who kind of crosses over. If somebody has something interesting to say, then who cares what they do the rest of the time?
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with that for sure. I think for me, the one thing that links it is that, you know, like Nate Silver has this gift for understanding and explaining statistics. Mine mostly, and I think it started with, because sports were the thing that I cared about before I cared about anything else, like as a child, is, and because the Mets were the team that I cared about the most, that like my actual area of expertise is frustration and disappointment. And that from there, I mean, that's obviously projectable across a wide stretch of our culture, from politics to, you know, entertainment to sports. There's always something that is going to make me upset, so I can bring that skill to bear on whatever it is that I'm talking about. But it's also, I mean, and for the Mets too, I mean, it's a team that's like got a ton of money, that's run by small-minded, ungenerous, petty people. It's really easy to kind of work from that in the direction of our national politics. It's really not a very long walk at all.
I do want to definitely talk to you about the Mets, because it's such a rich, juicy, moist subject to get into. I'm making it sound
insane. I can't even keep up with the shit. It's like this whole just the last 2 hours before we got on, so much stuff has happened. Yeah, but go ahead.
Absolutely. Before we do though, what I was going to ask, I want to talk about this with you, and because I think, I mean, you're the right person to talk about. Like I've never made a secret of the fact that I'm in therapy and that I struggle with depression. And one thing that I've struggled with since November is the political situation. Without turning this podcast incredibly political or even getting into what side I'm on, but I've said to my therapist that I don't know if this is a clinical issue, but you know, one of the main things bringing me down is that. And it's interesting to me how, and you're somebody who straddles both worlds that way with your commentary, the way sports plays into that. Because just to give you an example, the other day, I think it was Thursday, when the House passed their health care bill, there was a lot of day baseball going on that day. There were three or four games during the day. And when that news came down, as much as it's my job to watch those games, it became very hard for me. And I had the thought, like, who can watch baseball at a time like this? Because I know that you are sometimes affected by the situation as well, and that expresses itself in your tweets and in other things. How you rationalize the frivolousness of the things that we have to look at and talk about with the seriousness of the rest of the world right now?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's a really difficult question to answer. I mean, that's, again, also as somebody who is in therapy, has been depressed at various different times, you know, and has been depressed over these last few months for the same sort of reasons. And there's something kind of tacky seeming about talking to your therapist about, you know, foreign policy. Like, it just seems like you should be talking about your parents or, you know, some sort of other inherited neurosis that shouldn't be this sort of thing, but it's like that John Cornyn and his questions, you know. But
well,
it's,
you might be able to resolve the, if you're talking about your past, that you may actually come to an epiphany about that and be able to resolve it. But it's another thing to say, am I really going to pay for an hour talking about the Palestinian situation when
we're not going to
get any closer to the end either way?
And it's not going to make you feel any better. I mean, like, that's the, this is the thing that, in terms of dealing with the frivolousness of it, I mean, I've been through, I think, two big emotional cycles since the election. Just that immediate period in November and December was the worst time of my life. Not because of politics, you know, although obviously I think it would have been pretty bad if it had just been that, I should be clear about this too, that you and I both as New Jersey people, beyond, you know, what our particular politics are, that like there's a reason why people in New York and New Jersey and everywhere that Trump has done business rejected him as soundly as they did. It's, you know, why he got his ass kicked in Las Vegas the way that he did. And it's not just because, you know, we're all godless, rootless, cosmopolite types. I mean, it's everything that he's touched turns to shit. He ruined a major city in New Jersey, personally did it through his incompetence in Atlantic City. Like, everybody that lives there knows this. Like, nobody will ever trust him again. This is, and so to see that person ascend to power, you know, even when he was just an oafish joke, he wasn't ever cute to me. I mean, that was tough. And then I lost a friend at the end of last year, a very close friend. And
sorry.
And one of my friend's dads, it was all this stuff was happening. A guy I used to play basketball with, you know, just like several losses over the course of, you know, a few weeks. And I was trying my best to sort of keep up with my work because I had this idea that it would, well, certainly because it's my job to keep up with my work. That was a big part of it. And then also because I wanted to use the work to sort of get myself out of the moment that I was in, and especially because that moment seemed to be only growing darker every day. I mean, it was like deep regular season for all of this shit too. I mean, it was like right after the World Series ended, you know, but I was like, fine, I'll take it. I'll take the NFL, like anything. And, you know, it worked to a certain extent, I think. I also go back and I was reading over some stuff that I wrote during that period. I was still doing a weekly column then, which I'm not doing now. They are awfully dark. I mean, they gave me a lot of room to, you know, sort of write about whatever it was. I mean, basically the thing was I had to write about something that happened in the last week. And, you know, these were very eventful weeks for me. And I was not really bearing up terribly well at all. And it was, I think, useful for me to be able to, like, put that stuff down and try to really engage with it, you know, for more than 45 minutes on a couch on the clock while paying, which is, you know, all I do most weeks. But at the same time, you know, there's this obvious insufficiency to it all that, like, and not because the games don't mean anything, because they do mean a great deal. They mean, you know, something in the same way that art or literature or music means something. I mean,
right.
It's like whatever, life is very, very hard. Like anything that gets you up out of the muck for a few minutes is valuable. As long as it's not hurting anybody, I pretty much will sign off on anything that does that. That was hard. And then I think once I sort of got a wake up call at work, January and February, I've been trying to do different types of stories and dealing more with fan culture. And I wrote a story about a stupid baseball card. I mean, just basically things that have more explicitly to do with that idea of finding value in things that are otherwise no great concern or import. You know, obviously I'm dealing with some similar things as I was with the weekly column, but I think that this work feels like a less of a impossibly heavy lift and more of a sort of way of finding out how other people are able to get stuff from this, you know, take something out of the basic, normal, shared, extremely common experience of caring about sports and like what in that adds up to that necessary lift.
Well, you make a good argument for escapism. And it's funny because I was going to almost make an opposite argument. And I think maybe this is just rooted in my personality, because just in my personal life, in my relationships, if I had an argument, say, in my dating days with a girlfriend or even with a family member, and then I always try to keep in mind the reason that I'm in the relationship in the first place. So I want to get it resolved right away so I can go back to liking that person. Like if you and I had an argument, and I wouldn't want to let it sit for a month. I'd want to call you 10 minutes later or meet up with you and say, hey, can we talk this out? Because you're so much fun to be around. Why would I want you pissed off at me? Why would I want to be pissed off at you? Whereas a lot of people will always say, you know what? I need time. I need time to work. And I've never understood that. I've never been a I need time person. And so when it comes to the situation, which we'll call it like capital T, capital S, the situation, my urge is, no, we have to focus on this all the time. If my rule in relationships is the cliche, you never let the sun set on an argument. Well, the situation is the biggest, most important argument we've ever had. So, you know, don't pay attention to sports. Don't go to the movies. Don't do all that stuff. Hell, don't listen to this podcast. Just focus relentlessly on that till we somehow get it figured out. But your perspective on it, if I'm understanding what you're saying, is basically, no, back off from it. The games are important. Distraction is important. Have fun for a change.
Yeah. I mean, I think also you can do both of them at once. I mean, I agree. I certainly understand emotionally where you're coming from with what you said. And I've been there I spent a great deal of time there myself, but I also feel like there are times when I need to unplug. I mean, it's easier to say than do. For the most part, I think that I haven't really been able to get as fully outside of the current context as I would like to, just because this is the one, you know, beyond the stupidity of the moment, the one sort of signal thing about the national moment we have right now is that it's just like a fucking TV that never turns off. You know, I mean, it is, there's always something. The people that are in charge are incompetent and extremely cynical and cannot live without being on television. And this isn't even just Trump. I mean, that I think it's just these fucking guys will not shut up. And so there's always something to feel bad about. I mean, like, and I'm not the best at just not looking. Being at a game helps for me just because I watch it instead of looking at my phone or thinking about, you know, how bad things are going to get. I don't know. It's tough. I mean, there's also the other question of, you know, thinking about it all the time, really committing to it and devoting all your emotional energy to it. There's nothing wrong with that, except for the fact that there's only, it just makes you feel worse, or it makes me feel worse in a lot of ways, because there's nothing I can really do with it. It's not like me tweeting more is going to be the, you know, the thing that turns the tide. I can put it in as many different jokey formats as possible, but it's, I'm just fucking posting. Like, even just calling a congressman's office is the same. I do it. I've done it. I will do it again. But, it, you know, you just feel like you're sort of joining into this extremely large and long, you know, timetable collective work.
It's counterintuitive in a way, because you feel so empowered when you do tweet something, whether it's about politics or sports for that matter. You say the Reds are crazy to use that second baseman. They should be using this second baseman. Well, now you're smarter than the Reds, or at least you have positioned yourself to be that way. You're an authority. You're saying something. The world should change as a result of what you say. I mean, I'm not saying it really should, but you've sent this thought, this pronouncement out into the world, and it does feel like you're empowered, even if you got 10,000 retweets or something, nothing really does change. It's just you said something that people kind of liked.
Right. I mean, I think that's exactly right. And that's sort of the other thing with Twitter that is, I think, is important to keep in mind, and which I try to keep in mind, is that, like, it's a fairly unpopular, decidedly not profitable social networking or social media platform that's favored by certain types of journalists and a certain type of, you know, Nazi. And those
and just those two groups.
Yeah, they interact with each other there all day. And sometimes they're like, can you believe these cuck journalists? And then the journalists are like, why do they keep saying cuck? That's stupid. And then that's, you know, and then sometimes they send each other horrible pictures. It's not like nothing happens there. Like, your timeline has very little to do with the universe or the world that we live in. And I feel like that's, and yet at the same time, it's, you know, I prefer it to Facebook. So it's like I'm still spending plenty of time there. It's just like I'm trying to come up with some reasonable way to not just justify the amount of time that I spend there, but to use it as responsibly doesn't seem like the right word, but just not to get too far out over my skis in terms of what I think is going to happen or how meaningful it is if some stupid joke that I make does or doesn't hit.
I know some people are very invested in that. And I've had people say to me, Twitter is my social life. Well, I just wouldn't want to be in a stage where I would identify with that.
Yeah, same. I mean, it's weird though, because I think you and I are both, we're near each other in age, and I think that the way that that manifests with stuff like this is that we grew up in a time when there was no internet. True. And not just like grew up in a world where it wasn't there, but like during the period of time that we were either growing up or supposed to have been growing up, the world was smaller and different and a little bit more manageable, at least, you know, from moment to moment like that. And so there's still a part of me that thinks of everything that happens online is like this sort of larkish, weird, abstracted thing. Like, I remember the first time I went on the internet in high school, my parents got it, and we were just looking to see, like, there weren't websites, you know, that you could go to, like, some ESPN's website or whatever. I remember using a search engine, and we just looked up Mo Vaughn, my dad and I, and we found some, like, little kids. I mean, it's probably just like some teenager doing his best, like a fan website of Mo Vaughn's. And it was like scanned photos from the 75th row at Fenway. And then, like, you know, a scanned baseball card, like him kind of looking distracted with some terrible Donruss border around him. And the whole thing, I was just like, you know, whatever. Obviously, I did not have the thought at the time. But if you had asked me, like, is this going to last? I would be like, no, like, this is, why would anyone do this? Like, you could just, you know, what's going to be big is a TurboGrafx-16 or whatever, you know, just some like stupid. The people that I know from Twitter that I've met in real life you know, there are a few people that I've become friends with from there that
me too.
You know, I value very much. Yeah. And it's great. And I think that it's a great way to sort of get to know people. And yet I do think of them as different than, and think of them in a different sort of way than the friends that I made in elementary school and high school and college. And even, you know, in my early 20s here, when there was just less online to do, you know, that was the things that happen in the real world, I think, understandably and justifiably always feel that much more real.
Well, I think there's an experiential aspect to that. I mean, the friends that you meet in the real world, there is some, I mean, it might even be just over drinks, but particularly as you go back to your youth and, you know, this is the friend that I walked through the woods with. This is the friend that I did the book report with. This is the friend who was with me when I broke my arm. And there's a kind of a emotional wrapping or winding of both the person and your own history into something that maybe is a little more solid than, you know, I talked with this person on the internet and then we met up. And then at that point, you have to create that same bond of experience. And that takes time. They just haven't had that time in your life. And the harder thing is, it might be different if, as you said, you're a kid now, but you and I being older, married people, I don't know, maybe you get out a lot more than I do. I'm kind of reclusive. You know, there's less opportunity to build that. Mostly what you're concentrating on is building that within your family or within your coupleness with your wife.
Yeah. I mean, I have my work community and I try to see my friends and my sister lives here with her husband and they have two kids. So I see them as much as I can. But yeah, I mean, there is so much of the actual work of relationship building is something that I do, you know, moment to moment in my house.
Right.
Because like this is the person I care about the most, the person I spend the most time with. It's weird though. Kate and I were both talking. My wife, his name is Kate, but you know, but your listeners do not know. Now they do know.
But they should.
My wife... Lovely lady.
Very fine person, yes.
But she and I were talking about this over the weekend at the reunion that she was at. You know, I think that there's some element of maybe guilt on her part in terms of how well she had or hadn't kept up with people. And I think we both sort of feel, in a way that we acknowledge if we don't feel good about, that at some point we're just not really taking applications for new friends anymore. That, like, we have a lot. Like, you know, we're lucky we have the friends that we have. But, like, it's enough to maintain that, given how tired and stressed out we are, how tired and stressed out they are, and then you start factoring in the fact that a lot of them have kids. The idea of suddenly tacking an extra couple of happy hours with people you don't already know really well onto the week, it's more than I can take at this point. it's weird. That's like the part of getting old and, you know, seeing my parents going through it in some ways. You know, the way that your life sort of naturally shrinks. And there's a certain, like, lonesomeness, I think, that is just inherent in that. Even if you take care, even if you see your friends, I mean, that your world just gets smaller as you get older. You know, a lot of what's rotten in our politics and our culture, I think, reflects what that does to people, how small people can get
right
when they feel that way. Yeah, it's a very difficult thing to guard against. I think about it a lot.
Rather than continue down that uplifting, I mean...
Yeah. We could just continue directly in the direction of mortality and stuff. I got a tight 15 on that, if you're into it.
Well, dude, I can make that work with baseball. We can talk Lou Gehrig, Thurman Munson, Ross Youngs. Just do the whole grand parade of ex-baseball players. You brought up the Mets before, and instead...
you said this is getting less dark. already lied to your listeners and to me. Embarrassing.
Yeah, there's not. I can't disagree with you there. You used a phrase. I was looking over some of the Mets stuff you've written recently. Wait, before I get to that, so how far back do you go with the Mets? You brought up Mo Vaughn, but what's your early Mets memory?
First baseball cards I ever had, 85 tops, and I remember getting a Jesse Orozco card in there, and I asked my dad if he was good. And my dad's like, sometimes, like, he was just, you know, like, depends, really, situational, like, but I remember that as being, you know, the first Met, I think, that I ever really, like, recognized, and I was, the 85 tops would have come out in 1986, I would have been 8 years old, and those were, you know, some really good Mets teams. I think that I went to some Yankees games, I went to some Mets games. My dad was raised a Brooklyn Dodgers fan, and I think it just was not in him to try to bring me up as a Yankee fan.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, it was going to games with my family. All my friends from home are Yankees fans, but you know, we were able to make it work. It's just a sad thing that happened in that part of New Jersey, that there were a lot of Yankees fans being made around that time. You know, they've had very fulfilling lives, many of them, despite this, and I've done my best to support them in that. But yeah, I mean, I go back with them to when they were great. I mean, in 86, I remember my dad woke me up to watch the end of Game 6 in the World Series, which is something I remember very, very deeply. When I was in high school, they were bad and unfun. And then when I was in college, they were like starting to improve, but mostly starting to be fun. Right around the time I graduated was the Benny Agbayani administration. And those are still probably my happiest days as a Mets fan.
So you were out for like the Vince Coleman throws firecrackers at children period.
Yeah, I know. It seems embarrassing, right? So it's where I really should have. I mean, we went to games during that period of time. Like I have my parents are, I would say, standouts even amid a very crowded field of peers in the terms of the like elderly Jewish people that never throw anything away class. And they have in the downstairs bathroom at the house I grew up in, there's like all these magazines, just seemingly random, you know, like a National Geographic from 1996 or whatever, with, you know, like totally debunked weird shit in it. And there is a scorecard from a Mets-Rockies game. I think it was like 1994. Dennis Cook lost the game for the Rockies because he walked like five guys in a row. But I mean, like, it's my handwriting. Like, I was there. I definitely, like, you know, whatever, wrote Lance Johnson's name. I would have been, you know, sophomore in high school then, or it was not like something that was a huge priority for me. It was just something I did, you know, with my dad whenever we happened to get tickets.
Do your parents save the wrapping paper also? Because that's something I associate with my grandmother, that, you know, you don't just rip a present open. You carefully remove the wrapping paper because you might need to reuse it later.
Yeah, my in-laws do that. My parents do not. I don't want to make them sound sloppier than they are. Like, they're not wrapping the packages in the first place at this point. Like, it's just whatever. Like, something gets dropped off to you. Like, maybe the book seems like it's already been read. Like, maybe it has, but it's more that sort of move. Kate's parents, definitely, that's something that, this is all, you know, I go up, my wife's from Maine, we go up there at Christmas, and it's just an absolute Jewish person on safari experience for me still. And it's like a big fucking Christmas tree, there's snow, presents are wrapped, I'm opening them carefully because they're going to, if I play my cards right, it's going to be wrapped in the same paper next year. You know, that is just, it's a trip. It's like the same way I enjoy eggnog, where it's just like, it's so bizarre. And I mean, eggnog is like both gross and delicious at the same time, but mostly it's just like, there's no food more exotic to me than that. There's no experience to me more exotic than being in a room with like a bunch of very kind, but very like reserved New England people trying not to rip wrapping paper. It's just
You should bring a bottle of gefilte fish with you and then kind of have a cross-cultural exchange at that point.
Totally scandalize them. They're vegetarians, which is, if you like, there's an infinite number of excuses not to eat gefilte fish, but that's the one that I wouldn't push on them.
Yeah, you can't really do vegetarian gefilte fish. They have some vegetables in them sometimes, the more exotic varieties.
In the aspic.
So I was looking at some of your recent Mets commentary, and I was talking earlier about this wonderful turn of phrase that you have, and in talking about the Noah Syndergaard situation, which just to refresh people's memories, just in case they've forgotten already, he opened the season with injury problems. He refused an MRI. He went out on the mound. He immediately tore his lat, and now he's gone for who knows how long—a month, 2 months, longer.
They're saying three now. Apparently, it's not even going to throw for 6 weeks.
Right. So, I mean, pretty much just gone, if not for the duration, then for a good chunk of the season. And you referred in that piece to the team's how this situation was infused with a typical Metsiness quotient. And then you said it was hard to explain, but I think you let yourself off easy there. I think you probably can explain it. I'd like you to try anyway.
No, I'm happy to try. I mean, it is hard to explain, just in the sense that I think in the piece I went on to make some sort of modified, and again, possibly pretty lazy kind of Potter Stewart play on it. You know,
in terms no,
of
just, I don't like, think
if
it
you
was
tell, like what you described is Metsy. So if you reverse engineer the experience of taking this franchise ace, allowing him to like continuing to like push his starts back without any explanation, slow rolling what appeared to be he had a serious biceps soreness issue. He couldn't lift his arm above his head. That story eventually takes 3 days to come out. The Metsy thing is, it's twofold. it's really like a thousandfold, but it's twofold for our purposes here. It is, there's an initial obvious cock-up that can be taking a misdiagnosis or a diagnosis that is not understood sufficiently quickly or that is doubted too much or that is in any other way some bit of combination of magical thinking and idiocy relating to player health in this case or to anything else. And then there's the sort of the cataclysm in the middle. That's not one of the folds. That's just the thing that always happens. And then after that, there's the series of anonymous quotes from front office officials to the New York Daily News explaining that no one could have foreseen this, except for maybe one person could have foreseen it. And in many ways, it's no one's fault. But if it's anyone's fault, it's probably the player's fault, and so on. And so that, like, it's that. It's not just screwing up. It's this weird, sprawling, petty, recriminative response to it, which stands in for learning any lessons from the mistakes that keep happening. And this has been, I think, the hallmark of, I mean, not throughout the entire history of the organization, it's been very many different flavors of ineptitude on offer, but the Wilpon family ownership years, I think that is just 100% how they roll. Messy bitches who love drama.
I was thinking of today, and not to make light of a serious situation, but Jameson Taillon of the Pirates, the pitcher, he had surgery for testicular cancer. There's no joke involved. It's a very serious situation, and he confirmed. I mean, surgery for that can only mean kind of one thing, and he did tweet, in fact, that he's down one gonad. Now, I guess, yeah. is the thing, and obviously we both
way to not be like behind an account or some terrible fucking joke there. I respect you for that. Of course,
yeah. No, well. I wasn't gonna do. You know, you know that I'm a cancer survivor myself, so yeah. I wasn't gonna make light of that at all. And I'm sure we both wish him the very best in his recovery, because it's a very scary place to be. Even if anybody who's had this experience knows, even if you go to the dermatologist and they say, like, well, you got sort of a sketchy spot, we're just going to take it off on a precautionary basis, that's still a scary place to be, because you don't know what's going on. So we wish him the best. But it just occurred to me that if it were the Mets that who had a pitcher with that problem, that first they would have denied that he had it, and then they would have had him treated for an ear infection, and right. It would have snowballed, pardon the expression, from there.
Yeah, I mean, they had it today with Matt Harvey and his migraine, and basically the story of Harvey was suspended over the weekend for 3 games for an unspecified violation of team rules, suspended without pay, and then, you know, eventually these sorts of things do tend to come out, but whatever the opposite of, like, handling things in-house is, has been the Mets' hallmark in this. And it's continuing to happen over the course of, like, 4 or 5 days. There's leaks and counter leaks, you know, the Wilpons leak to one side. And you know, whatever, this all parts of the story, or at least it's got that kind of, like, Rashomon sort of somewhere in the combination of all these things and that synthesis. There's the truth behind this whole stupid thing. But the story that that Heyman had involved Harvey claiming to have had a really bad migraine to the point where he couldn't get to the ballpark, and then the Mets sending 2 security guys to his house that night to check and make sure that he was really there. They were greeted at the door by Harvey, looking apparently quite sick and wearing pajamas, and asked him a couple of questions and left. Not medical staff either. Like, these, like, 2 guys.
That's the MBI, Mets Bureau of Investigation, I believe, is the official designation.
Secretive, but also ineffective. Yeah, but I mean, it's just, like, so bizarre that they keep doing it this way. And yet, like, the inability to do it any other way is really the... I mean, again, like, you can see how this folds back into complaining about politics or whatever, right? I mean, it's like, I can't do a fucking thing about the Wilpons. I can make as many jokes about them as I want. I can write as many sharply worded blog posts as possible. But, like, they literally own the baseball team.
What's strange about that Harvey situation, in addition to the obvious resentment that seems to exist between the two parties, because... why wouldn't you? I mean, maybe there have been other occasions like this, but why wouldn't you err on the side of keeping things friendly and you cautioning the guy or warning him or fining him? But the public suspension is, as you said, is not handling it in-house. It's a humiliation kind of thing.
It absolutely is. I was just going to say, and why would this be? I mean, it'd be one thing if Harvey himself was a uniquely difficult person, and, you know, you hear things that say that he's difficult, you hear things that say he's misunderstood, whatever. This is their default. it's not just the guys that are like, you know, that have reputations as being kind of like difficult people. This is always, always the way. They never miss a fucking chance to do this.
Do you think that that kind of resentment, and this might be the Yankees fan that I grew up as speaking, and I was writing about this earlier today in that I was talking about a fluke season by Jim Spencer, who was kind of a Doug Mankiewicz kind of player, except he wasn't as good a hitter as Doug Mankiewicz, but he played forever on the value of his first base defense. And at 31 in 1979, he was with the Yankees and just somehow had this very fluky, muscled up and in about 300 at-bats, hit 20-something home runs and slugged 550. And George Steinbrenner...
It was a Glenn Allen Hill season?
Yeah, exactly. Over more at-bats, probably, but exactly. Yeah. But the key fact is he hadn't done that in his whole career. He's just a non-hitter, and he was 31. And nevertheless, that George Steinbrenner was so excited about that that he signed him to not only to a four-year deal, but he allowed the insertion of a clause that mandated that if a right-handed pitcher started for the opposition, Jim Spencer's name had contractually to be written into the lineup. Didn't matter if he was 0 for 100. It didn't matter if his head was broken. Like, he had to be in the lineup. Immediately next season, as you would have predicted, he regressed to his career form because guys usually don't discover a whole new level of production at that age. And of course, George Steinbrenner started talking in the media about how Spencer's overweight, how Spencer's not motivated anymore. And that was a very typical thing when you have been taken by a player, I don't mean that the Jim Spencer conned George Steinbrenner in some way, but when the Mets have had a crazy number of opportunities, at least judging by the rumor wire, to trade Matt Harvey over the years when he was at the peak of his power, and they didn't, and he's not there right now. So you wonder if the overreaction to this migraine, this lack of communication, comes out of them kind of a self-hating thing for not taking advantage of him when they could have.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, because at this point we're like, I'm happy to follow this where it leads, because I'm obviously, this is pretty much my shit, but like, we're psychoanalyzing my psychoanalytical spin on whatever it is that they're doing. Like, no one knows that. The Wilpons, for all I know, are really not deep thinkers to begin with, and so I can't necessarily expect them to know why they're doing what they're doing in this case. But yeah, I mean, I think there's a great deal of shame, and I think also of a really particular type of... It reminds me of the way that Phil Jackson tends to mishandle things with the Knicks, that there's a type of dickish older dude that is going to go out of his way to remind people who the boss really is. And the Wilpons seem, in this way, they do it in a very undermining, corny way. I mean, in terms of, like, a leaked quote to, you know, the Daily News is not exactly, they call it an alpha move. That general sort of like approach, that like constant kind of like nagging, negative, undermining thing, is, it's not a very flattering or cool look, and obviously it leaves a great deal to be desired as a management tactic, but I think that there is a sense to which these guys are kind of helpless before it. That, like, the Wilpons can't, I mean, the Mets mean a great deal to them, they refer to the team as a family heirloom, but they don't really seem to like the idea of any Met being better loved than them.
That might explain the Michael Conforto story as well.
Right. I mean, all that stuff. The Conforto thing is hard to tell, because, like, some of it is just the same backward-thinking stuff that afflicts other organizations. But, yeah, I mean, inexplicable. He's finally, like, pushed his way into the lineup, I think, to stay, just because you can't take him out when he's hitting like this. But, God, I mean, I was sure during the offseason that they were going to wind up trading him for, you know, like, 1 year of J.D. Martinez or something like that.
Let me give you one more historical analogy with the Matt Harvey situation, because the discussion of this today with the security stuff and the timeline of it almost makes you want to go into a Warren report like mode and gauge the, you know, scrutinize the timeline and everything. We talked before about the Mets Gestapo or FBI or Mets BI, whoever went to Harvey's door. And the question is whether they were concerned with his well-being or they were checking up on him. Mm-hmm. And I know that it might be that one side says one thing and one side says the other. And I immediately thought that, according to a piece actually published on FanRag, to the same website this here podcast originates on, by John Heyman, he said that the Harvey had texted Dan Werthen at 4 o'clock saying he had a migraine and he wasn't going to make it in, which, okay, was an hour later than he's supposed to notify them in case of of medical emergency, but put that aside, and that the Mets guys showed up at 10 o'clock to see, quote, how he was doing. If you really thought there was a problem somewhere between 4 and 10, rather than send guys out to his house, wherever that is, wouldn't you call 911 first?
Right.
I mean, it made me think of, and here's the historical analogy I want to give you, that in 1932, Gene Harlow was married to this guy named Paul Byrne, and Paul Byrne either was murdered or killed himself. The official reasoning was killed himself. But in some tellings of that story, that when the body was found, the first people who were called were not the police or the medical examiners or an ambulance, but MGM, where Harlow worked, so that they could doctor up the scene a little bit and keep her name out of the story. I'm not saying that that's what the Mets were doing. They weren't anticipating finding a smoking gun in Matt Harvey there. But if you were really concerned, wouldn't you call the cops?
Yeah. Or send somebody from your medical staff. Don't send, you know, whatever Anthony and like other Anthony from security to go look at the guy and make sure that he's not at fucking One Oak or something like that. I mean, it's like unbelievable that they would do it this way. And yet it is the most believable thing in the world because it is the only way that they ever do it. This is the thing, I think, that as you get older as a fan, it doesn't have necessarily to do with politics. I think it just means that you've spent more time in the world and sort of dealing with authority structures and people that have authority. At some point, the pettiness of it gets to be more depressing than the incompetence. You know, it's one thing to see, a vain senator making a decision that winds up hurting a lot of people. That's obviously not great, but at that time, you're dealing in a sort of this larger register of importance, and you know, it's a very different sort of context. And then to see that there kind of isn't an escape from that in the thing that's ostensibly an escape from that, that like even the team owners are shitheels. It's just a question of like how they're choosing to manifest it and how petty their performance of their personal shitheelery is, that like when that's the case, then like that's the where you start getting resentful. I mean, more than anything else, I can handle the Mets losing, but I would like for them not to freaking harsh my mellow. Like, do not remind me of Congress when I'm trying to read about my baseball team. Do you know what I mean? Like, Jesus.
That's what the Jose Reyes signing did for me, because, I always say I never root against a player. I may say in the course of writing something, I think that player A is going to do really well or player B is going to do really badly. And obviously I want to have a high degree of accuracy for my readers, but I certainly would never wish failure on a player just to make me look good. The one exception I might make is guys like Reyes, where I don't like being put in the position of having to root for somebody with that kind of background.
Yeah, same, obviously. I mean, you wrote a terrific piece for us at Vice Sports about that. I remember after it happened, that sort of, I remember touched on the Luis Polonia story with the Yankees. It's just similar. In this, I mean, just in terms of its ugliness and in terms of the way that the team was unwilling or unable to not just like grapple with, but even sort of basically understand that it was indeed as ugly as it looked. You know, with the Mets, it's complicated because of the fact that Reyes is so, you know, was so beloved a player. You know, when he left, he was maybe one of my favorite Mets of my lifetime. And there's still something about seeing him in the uniform with that number on the back that, like, there's a response that's wired into my head. You know, there's a thing that I do when I see Jose Reyes running around the bases. Like, I get happy. And yet at the same time, like, everything in, you know, everything that I believe, everything in my being is that, you know, he did something unpardonable. And, you know, if his wife's forgiven him and he's tried to do his best, then like, you know, that you can't ask for any more from him than that. It's just like, I just assume not.
I opened this particular episode talking about a question of forgiveness and about putting those kinds of things behind you. But as I also said, there's kind of a qualifier in there for acts of outright evil. And I do think that that is somewhere on the list.
Oh yeah, for sure. It's the sort of thing too, that I think never really happens in isolation. I mean, I think that beyond the fact that, you know, people make mistakes, there is such a thing as an isolated incident or whatever. It's like, if you would do it, if it is in you to do it, then there's a lot of things about you that are make you a person I don't want to know.
Never mind that situation, but that's a good rule of thumb in life, which is that if somebody, an acquaintance of yours, say, not that I'm talking about, I said that in a way that made it sound like I was talking to somebody very specific, yeah. Like, wink, wink, David, we know who I'm talking about. No, I'm talking very generally. if somebody shows the capability of being selfish, of putting their welfare well ahead of yours, they probably have the capability of doing that again.
Yeah. It's a hard thing to recognize about somebody too. I think that there's definitely, I don't know necessarily where I picked this up. I suppose it's a good thing, but I really am always surprised to sort of encounter real wickedness out there in the wild. I mean, I know that it's a thing that exists in the world, of course, and, you know, you see it everywhere. But I mean, the idea of most of, I think, the ways in which we wind up seeing evil in our country or in, the, you know, in our cities or whatever it is that we happen to be, I think, is the result of laziness and people just sort of being afraid, you know, that there's so much of this comes from shame and worry and just that, you know, sort of the less admirable moral calculus that can follow from that, things that you let yourself get away with. But the idea of actually encountering somebody that's not just petty, but cruel or bad. I mean, again, I don't know that Reyes is that sort of person. I know he did a really bad thing.
Right.
But it's it's a thought that you turn to baseball to not have to think about.
Exactly.
And in one way or another.
I mentioned Harlan Ellison before, and in regards to what you said about having that trouble suspending your disbelief that people are good. He once wrote somewhere a variation on a cliched phrase. He said, "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, and I'm a pervert."
Yeah.
And I think that's a good thing to keep in mind, because if you do get fooled twice, it's kind of on you for not getting hip to the situation.
Right.
But before we're pushing an hour, but before we call it quits, I do want to ask you that. I will candidly say I may regret asking this. Yeah, in that
I bet you will.
Well, I think you brought up Phil Jackson before and the Knicks, and I will profess an incredible ignorance of basketball. I've watched very few games. I've been to very few games. Somehow that sport and I have not clicked in a real way. I'm not saying that I don't like it, because I don't think I've experienced enough of it not to like it. I do know that I'm not good enough to play it. I'm not good. I mean, if you can't even hand me a ball, it would break like an egg. Like, I'm just that bad. I know that you spend at least as much time. I don't think you're a real football guy, as I understand it, but you spend it at least as much time on the NBA as you do on baseball. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so.
So here's a question. I think it dovetails with what it is that we've been talking about. You mentioned the Knicks. The Knicks have been miserable for a very long time now. And I don't think I know my history well enough to know that is it they last won a championship in the Bill Bradley days, like back then. So it's been a crazy long time.
Richard Nixon was president.
I have been, to the extent that I'm a football fan, and my commitment to football waxes and wanes, and sometimes I'm very into it. And then sometimes, especially recently, some of the moral questions about rooting for people who are causing themselves brain damage kind of deflects me. I've had the misfortune to be a Jets fan who I know for a fact have not won a Super Bowl since shortly before I was born or a year before I was born. It's just a dysfunctional situation that never seems to get any better no matter what happens. The Knicks strike me as that way.
They absolutely are.
The Mets are kind of that way, although they've been to a couple of World Series in this century. Kind of compare that, the Mets and the Knicks and the Jets, and what you see is in common with these sports teams, but businesses or management situations or whatever it is that leads to where they find themselves.
I think it's the bit that you identified about the ownership, you know, whether it changes or doesn't change. I mean, the Knicks are owned by James Dolan, who's the son of Charles Dolan, who's the man that brings you Cablevision or doesn't. He's a bad guy. He's an idiot, but a cruel one and a vain one, and is another dude that is always going to be, you know, and he doesn't have anything else going on. You know, he's got some sort of like terrible blues band that he's in, and they play at like 5:30 before like an Eagles show that starts at 9 because he's friends with Irving Azoff. But like he's a disaster, and the team is a disaster because it reflects him. That these are people that will not allow other people to have more authority than them. That means that the people that they wind up hiring, you know, to as either because they're, you know, servile or because they're controllable, the two are not mutually exclusive, obviously. That,
oh, like, man, I smell a political analogy there, too.
Do you? But yeah, I mean, they just sort of, it's, it becomes their particular psychodrama playing out through all this other, the sort of the proxy of like a team losing a basketball game by 16 points to the Pacers on a Tuesday night. You know, the for the Knicks, I mean, I think for Jackson, that was not an objectionable hire. I mean, he's got this terrific track record. He was, you know, he's a backup on the last Knicks team that won a championship and had been a very brilliant coach in the past, but was not interested in learning or changing. He was interested in proving that what he believed to be true was true. And I think that that's the team's struggles with the system that Jackson wants to implement, which was last used successfully in 15 years ago.
I never understand that. You see it less in baseball than you do in football, where somebody will come in and say, you know, we're going to run the West Coast offense, but they don't have the personnel to run the West Coast offense. So you're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole.
Yeah, and it's funny because I think with baseball, not that there's not very many different ways to play the game, but there is also a lower ceiling that is harder in terms of what you can do with it. You can't just say we're gonna put five shortstops out there. That's gonna be, I mean, like the Rays kind of do that, but it's an accident and it's all a platoon thing, and they all feel like right fielders anyway. But the way that the Phil Jackson, the triangle offense or whatever, to him, I think it has less to do with making the offense work and more to do with sort of proving some sort of point, the same way that I think that for Dolan, owning the Knicks is less about giving the people of New York something beautiful or fun to watch, or even giving himself a fun basketball team to watch, than it is having, you know, some other people to boss around in a comparatively low impact way. You know, not to abuse the hack Chekhov quote, but at some point every dysfunctional organization is different in its own way, but also like there's a fundamental alikeness to that. I mean, in terms of there's places that get things wrong because they're dumb. But I mean, if you look at the...
Were you reaching for the Tolstoy line there?
Was it Tolstoy? You can edit that to make me sound erudite, right?
Isn't it something like all happy families are alike, but all unhappy families are unhappy in their own way? Something
yeah.
like that.
Yes, that's what I was going for. Yeah, that like there's different ways in which this all manifests, but I think that like what it fundamentally comes down to is an unwillingness to take stock or be honest or to look at things and change them. There are ways in which this can be almost admirable. I remember I wrote about the Rockies in the Baseball Prospectus book a couple years ago, and I don't think I understood. I knew that they made a lot of really bad decisions, and I knew that the team also had this kind of like an evangelical culture that led it to function sort of like a, not like a Christian cult, but like a boring men's prayer group that met every day.
Right.
I don't want to overstate the thing, but they had been astonishingly static and were making decisions based on this, you know, decision matrix of like, how devout is Jamie Carroll? Oh, okay. Very devout. So how does 3 years, you know, $18 million sound or something like that? But they were doing it differently. They weren't going to change things because it didn't really fundamentally matter to them. They would just as soon win 75 games with a bunch of guys that believe the same things as them as they would try to take a shot at 90, but have, you know, an atheist or.
Right. Because in theory, you can make just as much money in baseball doing it that way.
Right. And I think that there is a lot of that, that with, you know, for the Mets, they have this very valuable television network. For the Knicks, I mean, James Dolan owns Madison Square Garden. They don't need it. So this is the sort of thing, if you think of it as a plaything or as a toy, and then you realize that the people that generally spend the most time with playthings and toys are children, then it all sort of starts to come together in a certain sense. It's just, it's disappointing because the team means something more to other people. And I think that like, as people care about it, they tend to invest it with a significance that's outside of that. You know, just the caring itself does a great deal to do that. And so that makes the abuse of the privilege that these guys have in owning these teams that much tougher to take.
That's the key. I think that you hold these teams in trust, even if you're the owner. Obviously, you know, we all think we're going to live forever, but you're holding that legacy in trust for not the next ownership per se, but the next group of fandom and for the fans that are out there now. And you're going to say this is one of my typical digressions, but there's a thing going on now with Marvel Comics where they're doing this endlessly long storyline where Captain America has turned out to be a secret fascist all along, and people are really dismayed by that. And I don't want to go necessarily. We don't have to break that down, but my point is that they too are They're holding that intellectual property. It's theirs. They can do whatever they want with it. They can do any story they want. They can paint a mustache on the guy. The reason that any of that matters is because people care that much. So they have a trust that it's in their own self-interest to honor that trust, to not mess up too badly because it means something to people.
Right. Respect it. It doesn't have to be the sort of thing where you're like, because two things can be true at the same time here, right? That you can say it's just Captain America. It's just a comic book. Get over it. It's just a baseball team. You know, whatever, doesn't matter. These guys don't know you. Get over it. Reasonable enough. And yet at the same time, the fact that people care about it means that it means something. I mean, I think that that's just, if you can't accept that, then I don't, you're living in a world of abstraction that is also probably pretty boring and sour. That like, if people, if it means something to somebody, then it means something. And if you don't respect that, then you're disrespecting the people that it means something to. And that's a, it's kind of like a cruel, corny, needlessly lame thing to do. Fred Wilpon.
I was about to say, I need to. Sorry. Steve, think of something to say so we don't end on that note.
No, I'm whatever. But yeah, I mean, you see what I'm saying. It's just like the meaningful part of it is the part that I try to focus on and that makes me happy. And then the other stuff, you just sort of wish everybody was nicer and, you know, whatever, like anything else in life.
One of the first things I ever wrote, not professionally, but sort of pre-professionally or pretend professionally, and I was a columnist for my high school paper, jumped all over to many different topics in many different areas as I do now. And I, retrospectively, I was ashamed of writing this. But in the very first column, I said something, and this is something only a young person, a 15-year-old would write. But I said, Yankees fans, if you are reading this now, meaning that you are also 15, chances are you will outlive George Steinbrenner. It's such a mean-spirited thing to say. And I don't retrospectively, again, not long after it came out, probably, I felt really bad about having written it. And yet the fans hold on that all this is just something that they hope that they can get through to get to the next good period, to get when Theo Epstein shows up.
Yeah.
Is really what it is, or the version of Theo Epstein who's going to be left alone, unmolested. And I wouldn't blame any Knicks fan for thinking it would have been Phil Jackson, given his track record, for example, who is going to drag this thing that you love into the light.
Yeah, it's not. It's. I mean, again, it all dovetails to things much bigger and more, you know, objectively important than sports. But that is, it's about belief, and it's about the belief that things can change. And without that, life is very difficult. Sports are intolerably stupid and petty and small. You know, like, this is the idea. And I think that, you know, whatever, the Steinbrenner thing, of course, it's terrible to think about somebody dying. And yet at the same time, with Steinbrenner is an abstraction in that case. What he stands in for is the sort of thing that everybody hopes that they get to outlive. You know, the idea of some sort of arbitrary tyrant messing with your fucking leisure hours. Like, I sure hope that I outlive that.
I just wanted a third starter and maybe a shortstop. That's all. I would have been forgiven if not for that.
I wasn't thinking globally. I was actually hoping for Richard Dotson. And
they kept trying. They really, Steve Trout. I said Steve Trout was a placeholder. Here is Steve Trout.
Let's hear it.
At last, the younger fans today have the better Trout to deal with and not the gray hairs that resulted from the original model. He wasn't the original model. There was Dizzy Trout before him. David, thank you for being part of this and being a regular part of this in the future. I really, really enjoyed this. It's a different perspective, which is what anybody who reads your stuff would have known you would have brought to the table.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you always. Thank you for having me.
Holy moly, we've come to the end of episode 3. I really want to thank you. We had a huge jump up in listeners between episodes 1 and 2, and we've gotten some great feedback at our email address at infiniteinning@gmail.com, and I'm really gratified how many people have told me that they are enjoying this new program. So thank you so much. I'm having a great time, and I am so gratified that you are too. Thanks again to David Roth for coming by. If you want to read more of his fine work, you can find him at Vice Sports, and you can follow him. All the cool kids already do, but just in case you don't, on Twitter at David_J_Roth. Yeah, it's a little bit of work, but it's worth it. You can find me there at Go Stephen Goldman. Hey, it's affirmational. And of course, you can read me more 3 times a week on fanrag.com, and sometimes I show up at Vice as well. It's still early for us to have a sponsor, so I'll just thank Mom and Dad for buying me lunch and say that we're brought to you today by the number 42. Our theme song, which you've heard throughout the episode, was composed by myself and Richard Mooring. The producer, well, he's a wanted war criminal, and I hope to turn him in soon. Assuming the creek don't rise, I'll be back next week with special guest Mike Farron of SiriusXM, and we'll have more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.